Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Hi, this is Julissa Arce, and in this week's Crooked Conversation, we talk to Hiroshi Motomura, who is a preeminent immigration scholar. He's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, and he's the author of a number of books, including books that are used in law schools all across the country. I was really excited about this conversation because there's been so much attention on the hashtag Abolish ICE. And I was just really interested to hear from Hiroshi to put some context around where this hashtag came from, what ICE is, what it does, how it's different than Border Patrol, how it's different than where people go apply for their citizenship and green cards, what ICE is notorious for doing wrong, and where we can go from here. So have a listen. I hope you enjoy it. So thank you, Hiroshi, for joining us on this Crooked Conversation. I am really excited to talk to you about this because, like, every time we have conversations about it, I feel like I learn so much from you. And what I want to do is, before we sort of get started on the conversation about abolishing ICE, is to set some context about what ICE is, what it does, where it came from, why it even exists in the first place. So if you could tell us, or put ICE in context, like, when was ICE created and why was it created?
Sure. Thanks a lot for having me. This is, I think, a very important conversation, an important topic. And I think it is useful to start with where I started. ICE has been around for about 15 years, and it was created as part of the reorganization of immigration regulation in the federal government. And that essentially is in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. So folks may recall that after 9/11, there was the concern about Homeland Security, as it came to be called, and the department was created. And so that occasion was the occasion to reorganize a lot of the immigration functions in government. And so what happened is that you had different agencies created within DHS. One of them was on the border. It's called Customs and Border Protection. One of them had to do with giving people what are called immigration benefits, in other words, citizenship, green cards, student forms to let people come into the United States as students. That goes to United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, USCIS. Mm-hmm. And then there's something called U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. That's ICE. And so their main jurisdiction is in the interior of the United States. So you have a border agency that's enforcement oriented. You have an interior agency, that's ICE, that's enforcement oriented. And then you have an agency that's supposed to process applications and grant benefits and citizenship and things like that. And that all dates about 15 years ago. It's very much part of the legacy of 9/11. Of course, there's a history before that. For so many years, really, since the 1940, all these immigration functions were in the Department of Justice. And so when people, sometimes you often hear the initials INS, Immigration mm-hmm. and Naturalization Service, that's where it was before 9/11. And so that's from 1940 on up until 2003.
One thing that I'm glad you brought up is the fact that there are three distinct agencies within the Department of Homeland Security, and they're supposed to have different jurisdictions and are supposed to have different activities that they do. And one of the things that I often get very annoyed about is when people confuse Customs and Border Patrol with ICE, and they use them interchangeably. Like, oh, you know, ICE, we support ICE because they keep our border secure. And it's like, well, ICE doesn't really do that. There's Border Patrol that does do that. So I'm glad that we cleared that out. There are two completely different agencies.
Yeah.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about this sort of history of ICE, and you mentioned that this really came about after 9/11. And, you know, as an immigrant, 9/11, I feel like, really changed the way that the United States viewed immigrants in this country. And from my perspective, that's when they really started to criminalize immigrants a lot more. And mm-hmm. it came from a standpoint of almost treating immigrants as though we were terrorists. And so, do you think that there's some truth to that? Did 9/11 change the way that the United States viewed immigrants?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good observation. In the following sense, that 9/11 was a point when immigration really gets portrayed in a lot of public media much more heavily as a national security issue, mm-hmm. and that's the whole point of creating DHS, and that's the whole point of going with ICE in the interior. But I have to say that a lot of the demonization of immigration and immigrants that we're seeing, especially today, has a phase that certainly predates 9/11. A lot of the reason that the government has many more legal weapons to deport people now have to do with changes in laws that took place in the mid-90s, especially in 1996. And so if you're looking at the modern history, just in this past generation of immigration enforcement, a lot of it stems from laws in 1996 that made it easier to deport people, but also to really short-circuit due process in a lot of cases. So that happens in the mid-90s, particularly in 1996. And then overlaid on top of that, you get the national security angle, mm-hmm. Which is a little bit different. But it's a national security angle that's overlaid after 2001. And so right now you're seeing in the political rhetoric, especially out of Washington, you're seeing both of these strands. One is a criminalization story, and the other is a national security / terrorism story. And so you're seeing both of those things. And I think one dates, as you say, clearly back to 9/11. But there's another that dates to the certainly to the mid-90s. And, you know, if you really think back even further in history, immigrants have always been scapegoats in one historical time or another. And that's been true for much of the country. And so, you know, if you really want to look into the history of this, it goes back way before 9/11. It goes back way before the 90s. It really goes back to a lot of the racial restrictions that were part of U.S. law for basically most of its history.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's something I, in more simple terms, like I tell people that, you know, first of all, right now, there isn't like a line that everybody can get in. So there's a lot of people who cannot become American citizens or permanent residents. Mm-hmm. And historically, like you said, there were a lot of restrictions on race. And depending on what race you were eligible or not eligible to become a citizen. But focusing on this conversation about enforcement, you said that prior to 9/11, there was an enforcement mechanism within mm-hmm. INS, I'm assuming.
Right. It was part of INS, yeah.
I think most people are familiar with ICE in the context of deportations and ICE deporting people. But what are some of the other activities that ICE carries out?
Well, ICE does a lot of different things. I think you're right that most of what has gotten attention recently has been the process of what I think of as arrests, or even before arrests, figuring out who they want to go after. Some of that's going to involve who's got who has a prior order, a deportation order, or technically it's called a removal order, who those folks are. There's a whole mechanism for arresting people. There's raids. The raids can be in homes or in workplaces or just really pretty much anywhere. There's a huge detention apparatus. In other words, the people who are apprehended are put in essentially jails or prisons. I mean, and a lot of them are run not by the government directly, but they're under private contract. Mm-hmm. And then there's a mechanism, a kind of a pipeline, if you want to think of it that way, to actually physically deport people. And this is basically interior enforcement. There's also some attention made to investigations of serious criminal activity in terms of trafficking, things like that. Although a lot of those parts of ICE apparently have been catching up a little bit on the news on this, that a lot of the people who are concerned with serious criminal investigations associated with trafficking of human trafficking and things like that are really concerned that the attention to just sort of arresting people in their homes and communities is taking away from some of the more serious work that they're trying to do. And all this, as you point out, you know, takes place in the interior. It's really distinct from what takes place in the border, which interestingly, by the way, is in two different setups on the border, because in the border, the Customs and Border Protection, part of those folks are the ones that you show your passport to if you come back into the country at the airport, for example, and then the Border Patrol is a separate group of people within that. So even the border agency is divided up into different groups.
Hmm. Can you tell us a little bit more about what those groups are?
Well, one of them is the people who are doing inspections at port of entry. So these are the people who would do they'll check your they check your papers, your visa, or your passport if you show up at the airport and want to get into the country. That's true if you're a returning U.S. citizen. It's also true if you're coming to study or something like that. And they're also at the ports of entry at San Ysidro or wherever it may be. And then you have people on the border. And so the Border Patrol people are the ones who are trying to apprehend people who are trying to cross the border, whether it's crossing through the desert in Arizona or New Mexico, or whether it's trying to climb the fence someplace.
Hmm. One of the big reasons why Abolish ICE, this hashtag, has come about, it's come as a result of all of the media coverage that has come from families being separated at the border. And I think one of the pieces of confusion, or at least that I've also, frankly, been confused about, is when these families are presenting themselves at the border, who are the first people that they interact with? Is it Border Patrol? Is it ICE? Do at some point, do they change hands between Border Patrol and ICE? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, it really depends on the situation and the geography here. But let's say and there are, of course, many thousands of people in this situation, or tens of thousands of people fleeing really desperate circumstances, violent conditions in Central America, and they've decided that they're going to try to pursue get some kind of protection in the United States. And so if they were to go to the port of entry in San Ysidro and say, I'm turning myself in, I want to apply for asylum, the person they'd be dealing with there on the U.S. government side would be an employee of Customs and Border Protection. And so that would happen if they were just walked up to the place where you would cross the border in a car, for example. But let's say you're in a different situation, and the people we're talking about who've traveled overland from Central America, let's say that they are not in the border in an urban area south of San Diego, where San Ysidro is, but instead in the middle of the desert or someplace in the Rio Grande Valley, then they would the first person they encounter from the U.S. government would likely be a Border Patrol officer, Border Patrol agent. And so that would be a different agency. The U.S. law requires the government employee, whoever it is, to put these folks into a process where the law tests, the strength of their asylum claim. And so if they get put in detention, and is often the case, and we're hearing a lot about family separation, which is, part of the detention process, those folks would eventually get transferred to ICE, because ICE is the agency that is operating these facilities. And these facilities are all around the country. There's about, at any given night, 35,000 beds that are occupied.
Of those beds that are occupied are Congress mandated quotas.
That's right. I mean, they're mandated in different respects, in terms of the beds have to be. Congress really said, we want you, the executive branch, to take seriously the need to hold people, and so there's a mandate to fill these beds. There's also categories of people that Congress said may not be released. So that in itself accounts for a lot of people. And there's a lot of problems with this.
Right, because if you have to meet a certain number of people that have to be in detention, then it's like, you're incentivized to detain people. And if you can't find the quote unquote criminals, well, then you're going to go after anyone who's undocumented.
Yeah, it's also problematic just from the point of view of just how the government runs, because you're seeing a lot of private prison companies build these facilities in various parts of the country. So there's private profit being made off of this.
And then those same private prison companies are the ones donate money to politicians and their campaigns.
That's right. That's really a vicious cycle there. And then the other issue is that there are a lot of alternatives to detention. And I think that a lot of the people who've been advocating for more detention have essentially ignored or tried to ignore the fact that a lot of the rate of showing up for your hearing is actually quite high, especially if you give people especially if people have legal representation, because the system is so complicated the success rates by getting a lawyer are shockingly higher by getting a lawyer. And the reason I say shockingly is that it's really no way to run a system of trying to protect people fleeing desperate circumstances if the one thing that really makes a difference is getting a lawyer. But over on top of that fact, the involvement of a lawyer and the sense that, hey, I'm going to get a fair shot in court. I'm going to really have someone hear my story, an immigration judge, and someone's going to help me walk through that. That really gets people to show up. So the idea that people disappear in tremendous numbers is a myth.
Yeah. So just to back up on that point, for listeners that aren't as familiar with the process. So if someone presents themselves at the border to seek asylum, or they try to cross the border and they get detained and they end up at a detention center, there's a couple of things that can happen. One is they can be detained, they can be jailed for an indefinite amount of time, or they can be released and they can be given a court hearing at some point in the future so they can present their asylum case in front of a judge.
Right.
And what's happening right now is that more often than not, people are being detained, they're being jailed because people use this excuse of like, well, they're not going to come back. If we just, quote, catch and release, they're not going to come back. They're not going to show up. But what you're saying is that people will actually show up. There is a high percentage of people that do come back to their court hearings, especially when they have a lawyer and they feel like their case will have a good chance of being approved.
Yeah, and sometimes in these cases, you have a combination of really bad events, because if they're put in detention, it just makes it really hard to get a lawyer. But if they were allowed to be released, with a court date, then they would, in many cases, are able to move to a place where they're close to relatives, where they can get some help, and including legal help. I'm not saying that everyone will show up. I mean, I would admit that there are people who aren't going to show up, but I think numbers are really overblown of people who don't show up. And then the other part of this, and this is more from a rule of law and a justice point of view, I think it's very disturbing that, in effect, the prospect of indefinite detention, and recently we've seen the prospect that you're going to be separated from your children, very young children, is really deterring people who should be getting asylum under U.S. and international law. It's deterring people from even making their case. So what's happening is detention is being used as a deterrent, and from that point of view, to undermine the rule of law, because the U.S. and by that I mean that U.S. law has incorporated or adopted international law obligations to protect people who are fleeing persecution. I'm also not saying that everyone who's fleeing is going to qualify, but a significant number will. And you're really subverting the system if you don't give people a fair shot at making their case.
We'll be back with more of this Crooked Conversation with Hiroshi Motomura. Crooked Conversations is brought to you by The Farmer's Dog. Dog food companies claim to use all natural ingredients, but what kind of beef or carrots can sit on a shelf for years? We can't eat highly processed food every meal and be healthy. I've tried it, didn't work. And neither can your dog. The healthiest food for your dog is real, fresh, unprocessed food. Introducing The Farmer's Dog, the company helping dogs live longer and healthier lives with fresh, ready-to-serve meals delivered directly to your door. And I wish they would have had this when my papa was still around. Clever marketing has convinced pet owners to feed unhealthy, highly processed kibble, but The Farmer's Dog is different. Complete with a short questionnaire and a vet-developed meal plan is created just for your dog. Food arrives at your door in pre-portioned packs ready to open and pour. It's easy, and it looks and smells like real food because it is real food for your dog. And food matters. Studies show that even adding fresh food to your dog's diet can reduce cancer risks by 90%. Start feeding your dog better food today. Get 50% off your 2-week trial of fresh, healthy food at thefarmersdog.com/crookedcombos. That is thefarmersdog.com/crookedcombos. Plus, get your free shipping. Just go to thefarmersdog.com/crookedcombos to get 50% off your first 2 weeks. That's thefarmersdog.com/crookedcombos. One of the things that you write about and you've written about in your books and in columns is this idea that some types of enforcement can actually undermine the rule of law. And if you take the precedent at its word, that, you know, he's a rule of law precedent, but then you look at some of the activities that are happening within ICE and Border Patrol and USCIS, it's a lot of the policies and the policy changes that are happening seem like they're actually undermining the rule of law, right? Because you had written this piece where you talked about how back in 2011, the then director of ICE, John Morton, set guidelines for enforcement around ICE and like who should be prioritized for deportation and arrest. And what was crazy to me when I read this piece was not just that ICE officers opposed it, like the union opposed it, but then the union prevented ICE officers from going to training for those new guidelines.
Yeah, I mean, that was their initial position. But I think it's very emblematic of what was going on. And that is that when the Obama administration tried to set out some guidelines for how ICE should operate in the interior of the country, it basically said, there are some priority cases, you know, people who are national security risks and people with serious criminal convictions. And we, meaning the people in Washington, we want the field offices and the agents to prioritize those things. And that would be the enforcement priorities. And so when the Obama administration came up with these guidelines, there's a lot of resistance in the field, as you said. And I think that reflected the idea that people in the field should be allowed to make decisions that they want to make. And so I think that what Obama was trying to do in the interior was to rationalize and really bring some kind of order and transparency to the system to make sure that ICE officers were not, for example, just racially profiling in order to make their arrests. And I'm not saying that every ICE officer was racially profiling, but the problem was that you'd never know unless you had these guidelines and some transparency. And so that's what's happening. And I think that's a lot of what's behind the abolish ICE movement today. It's really, you know, that hashtag can mean a lot of different things. But at its core, I don't personally see it as a call to for open borders. I personally don't see it as a call to end enforcement altogether, but rather as a call to do it the right way. Now, having said that, I mean, this the abolish ICE hashtag includes a lot of people who have very different kinds of views, and some who are using the hashtag for and have different goals in mind. But I think at its core, it's really a call for to abolish a certain kind of rogue agency mentality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I mean, there are a lot of issues with ICE, right? One which you kind of alluded to, which is this sort of almost like discrimination and who the people that they're going after. Because if there are no guidelines and anyone who's undocumented essentially becomes a priority, so that's 11 million people who all of a sudden are priorities for deportation. And, you know, I always tell people, like, if some random people are walking down the street and it's me and a white person, like, who do you think they're going to ask to see their papers? Right.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
Like the reality is that they're probably going to ask me because I'm brown. And you see that happening more and more. You see, there's been a lot of case studies about detention centers and how horrible they are, and women getting abused in detention centers, women miscarrying because they're not given the proper medical treatment that pregnant women need while they're in detention. I mean, the fact that we have pregnant women in detention, like, first of all, just drives me crazy. But so there are a lot of issues with ICE. And I agree that there's a lot of things that need to change about ICE, whether it means that the entire agency goes away and is replaced with something else. I don't know what it is. And you're right that this hashtag is being used in so many different ways. So I wanted to ask you whether you think that there is anything detrimental to this hashtag. Because one of the things I've seen is the hashtag being used against us, almost against the immigrant rights movement, saying that, you know, we are calling for open borders, that, you know, the president's tweeted a bunch of things like Democrats are weak on crime and their love is on MS-13, even though ICE isn't really even focusing on MS-13 gang members. And a lot of MS-13 gang members are U.S. citizens. So, but maybe that's a topic for another crooked conversation. So do you think that there's anything detrimental to using this hashtag and the fact that it's not being used in a consistent way?
Well, you know, like a lot of political hashtags, or I guess they used to call them political slogans, but I guess slogans have become hashtags these days. you know, it can mean a lot of different things to a lot of people, and it's energized a lot of politics. And I think just having public attention to this issue is a really good thing, just for the sake of public debate and calling attention to some problems we have. But I think it is a double-edged sword because, you know, it reminds me a little bit of the word sanctuary. You know, because on the one hand, sanctuary, I think, stands for a lot of things that are positive. In fact, I think it does stand in many ways for the rule of law, because a lot of cities that are calling themselves sanctuary cities are really saying, we think the rule of law means consistent law enforcement, non-discriminatory law enforcement, transparent law enforcement, and so that's what we mean when we say sanctuary. We just don't want you to, you know, be profiling these neighborhoods and undermining police protection for minority communities in particular. On the other hand, I think a lot of the opponents of sanctuary cities are using that word in some ways to imply that the sanctuary movement is lawless or just mere resistance without principle. And I think that's an unfair characterization, but I think that's what's happening to some extent with the sanctuary movement. And abolish ICE is kind of the same thing, but perhaps even more so, because I think that, is, you know, as I said, that for me, the idea of abolish ICE is, if this would be too long for a hashtag, it would be abolish ICE as an agency that fosters rogue behavior by field agents who are going to be discriminating and acting in a lawless way without ever getting caught.
That doesn't even fit in a tweet. That's
that's right. That's
that
my
sounded
hashtag.
More like 240 characters.
But abolish ICE is really a way of saying that, right? And
yeah.
So I think the word ICE in abolish ICE is not being used at its core as abolish, not even to say abolish enforcement, but rather say there's a right way to do it. And it's not the way it's being done. But you're absolutely right. There is a political downside to this because there's going to be this this idea that if you're if you don't like the way ICE is set up, that somehow you're, you know, I don't know, pro-criminal or something like that. I mean, I think that this is one of these cases where you've got a lot of misinformation out there. And, you know, I hope that a lot of people, most people are, you know, can see through that. And I think that, you know, the family separation issues become crucial or maybe it's even a watershed moment in that regard, because I think that to the extent that abolish ICE means let's stop this business of
detaining people
and kidnapping
children.
Their children. Yeah, and I mean to get people to not you know get what they're supposed to get under U.S. international law, then that really becomes then abolish ICE. You know, really becomes abolish a way of thinking about enforcement. And, but you're absolutely right that there's a downside to this. And yet I think it people have coalesced around the idea that this isn't the right way to do it. Some of this, going back to what you were saying earlier, is a bit of a legacy of the post 9/11 drive to create DHS, because one of the things that was always a hallmark of the Immigration Naturalization Service, INS, is that it was an agency that had an enforcement piece that became ICE, but and Border Patrol and the people at the ports of entry. But it also was an agency that was the place you went to get a green card. You know, I remember my own family went down to the INS office and got interviewed for, you know, citizenship. And so it wasn't always an agency where the service side helped temper the enforcement. You know, the service side was reminders of the enforcement people that they weren't just about enforcement. They were really about welcoming new Americans. You know, and then the people who were administering the process to give people citizenship and green cards, you know, they were reminded by the presence of the people who were involved in enforcement that there are a few cases that maybe shouldn't be granted, you know. And so there was a bit of a both sides were kind of tempering the other. And the distinction between benefits and enforcement is really hard to draw anyway. And so there was this agency that was a little – some people thought it really had a bit of a split personality, but it wasn't such a bad thing. And so what happens is after 9/11 – this gets back to your original – we were talking about earlier. After 9/11, what happens is it gets split up. So then it's a system where it's easier to be hyper – enforcement oriented, and then the other part of this is budget, because the money has gone to the enforcement, and Congress has essentially set up a system where the application side of this has to fund itself through application fees, but then the application fees have gotten astronomical for working people, and so you know, so there was this whole sense that the people who are the part of the what used to be the INS were. That was trying to basically build a stronger America through immigration is the part that got the short end of the budget.
Crooked Conversations is brought to you by Quip. 75% of us don't refresh our bristles every 3 months, let alone visit the dentist every 6 months. That's why you need Quip, to put a necessary yet annoying aspect of your personal care on autopilot. Quip's subscription model is a thoughtful, inexpensive solution for people who want to make it easy to keep up with simple habits, like brushing your teeth. Let Quip do the thinking for you when it comes to your teeth. So, what makes Quip different? For starters, Quip is an electronic toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes, while still packing just the right amount of vibrations to help you clean your teeth. Quip's built-in timer helps you clean for the dentist-recommended 2 minutes with guiding pulses that remind you when to switch sides. Next, Quip's subscription plan are for your health, not just your convenience. They deliver new brush heads on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. I can kind of hear like Pitbull doing the Mr. Worldwide. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel wherever you take your teeth. And you take your teeth everywhere. So Quip. And finally, everyone loves Quip. They were on Oprah's O list, name one of Time's best inventions, and it's the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Plus, they're backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists, and hundreds of thousands of happy brushers use Quip every day. Get your first refill pack free at getquip.com/crookedcombos. Spelled GETQUIP.com/crookedcombos. Whew, I got through all that.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.
It's not just with ICE that you see the anti-immigrant agenda coming through, right? I mean, you see it within USCIS also. I mean, just the fact that we...
That's true.
Even from small... I don't think it's a small thing, but from things like removing Nation of Immigrants from the mission of USCIS to now having a denaturalization task force. So, you know, where before, I think over the last 3 decades, there have been like 11 cases, denaturalization cases that the government pursued a year. And now between ICE and USCIS, something like over $200 million are going to be spent in trying to find people to denaturalize. So, right. I mean, this is, you know, it's not just ICE that it's like rogue and really looking at immigrants as criminals.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right to point that out about some of the trends in USCIS. I do think that the removal of the idea of Nation of Immigrants from the website, it seems like a small thing, but it's hugely important from the way the agency expresses what its mission is to the public and also internally. What I'm afraid of is not just this denaturalization task force per se. I mean, that's troubling for all kinds of reasons in and of itself. But actually, the bigger problem is that it creates a climate of fear so that people who are fully entitled to citizenship, for example, entitled in the sense that they've met all the requirements and they're paying their fees and they met all the pass the test and that kind of thing or getting a green card, they're going to be deterred from applying for the things that Congress said that they should get because of some fear that that something that they, you know, left out inadvertently, even on an application, that kind of thing will be used to not only deny them, but to lead to the deportation. And that may be not necessarily a factually grounded in every case, but I think it's a climate. It's either a climate of fear or at least of apprehension, and it means that people who would under any other circumstances say, I want to join this country and be a U.S. citizen, they're turned away. And I think that what you're seeing is kind of a callous disregard of actually it's the rule of law in that part of the process too.
Yeah. I mean, I was in D.C. a couple of weeks ago giving like a welcome. I was like the keynote speaker at a naturalization ceremony. Mm-hmm. And it, for me, was sort of like this big full circle thing because I was undocumented for 15 years. And then here was like a formerly undocumented person, now a U.S. citizen, like welcoming a set of new American citizens. And like, but as soon as I left, I started reading all these things about this denaturalization task force. And I'm like, what the F? Because, you know, we've been through years of background checks and fingerprintings and interviews, and it seems like it doesn't matter how much we do or how right we do it, you know, whether it's from presenting yourself at the border to seek asylum and now you're being jailed for doing the legal thing to do, which is to present yourself at the border to seek asylum, and that is a legal thing to do, to applying for citizenship after you've had a green card for 3 to 5 years. So you've already waited in line, as people often say, wait in line. You did that. You've done everything right. But even at the point of of naturalizing, there is still this fear that, is there something in my application? Did I do everything right? Like, should I even apply if this can be taken away from me and then I can be deported? Maybe I'll just stay a green card holder and not become a citizen, and then I won't become a voter. And then,
So. That's right. And I think there's a lot of that. I mean, there's at least a sort of a disregard of those consequences on the part of this administration. In other words, that they either don't care or
they're doing it intentionally.
Or they're doing it intentionally. And in many respects, this is evident in taking the Nation of Immigrants idea out of the website, but it's also in some of the whether it's the rhetoric or the legal proposals to try to cut legal immigration. I think what we're seeing is really a reaction against a lot of the demographic change in this country that's taken place since 1965. Yeah, yep. I mean, it's immigration to the United States was explicitly racially restricted until 1965. In fact, racial restrictions on becoming a U.S. citizen weren't taken out of U.S. law until 1952. And so during that entire period until 65, there was an attempt that was very explicit in the laws to try to preserve the ethnic mix of the United States as it existed in the late 1800s. In other words, to keep it as not only European, but to keep it Northern and Western European. And so, what you're seeing right now is some of a nostalgia for the so-called good old days when America was much more European. And you're seeing this sentiment in everything from the president on down. And so that's also, I think, what you're describing in that sense of what you experienced at that naturalization ceremony. I mean, I have to admit that I went through a naturalization process that my mother did too, and so I understand what that's like, both from the perspective of the precariousness you feel in the interview, but also the sense that now I can really contribute to this country. Mm-hmm. We try to do that. And having that cut off is a deeply troubling thing. And, you mentioned the people who could get arrested, by ICE because they're undocumented here. And you mentioned 11 million people. But of course, I mean, I know you know this, but just to underscore the point is that it's not just 11 million people. It's also all their citizen relatives and children and parents and brothers and sisters. And so we're talking about not just people who are not citizens, not just people who are undocumented, but all the people who are part of their communities, many of whom are U.S. citizens, in many respects, in many cases, long-time U.S. citizens.
Yeah. No, that's right. I'm glad you mentioned that, because we've also seen a lot of reports even of people who have green cards, people who are in the country legally, who are still being targeted for deportation, and even U.S. citizens who have been wrongly deported. So I'm glad that you said that. I could keep talking to you for like a really long time, but just for the sake of time, I always like to finish my Crooked Conversations asking my guest what gives them hope. So what gives you hope for a better immigration system?
Well, this is a tough moment in which to have hope, because I think that the onslaught on immigrants and not just on immigrants, it's not just bad on immigrants, but it's also on America's position in the world. What gives me hope is that there are many people in this country who understand that what's going on is a reaction to a lot of change, positive change that's taken place in the country. I'll use the benchmarks for since the 1960s, since the Civil Rights Movement, since the end of racial discrimination and immigration laws. This country has changed tremendously in just who's here and who's welcome here. And I think that that's a that's a force, the force of people, not just at a national level, but also at the community level, you have to sort of stop and think about it. But when you do, I think it becomes obvious how powerful that is. And that's what gives me hope. Some of it's at the level of voting and traditional political things like that, but a lot of it is also at the level of the resilience of people in everyday communities and everyday lives to understand that a lot of what's made this country great has come through immigration over the years, and that's what gives me hope that is a theme in American history that taking Nation of Immigrants out of the USCIS website is not going to change.
Yeah, I like that. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I hope you enjoy that. I was taking notes like crazy, even as I was speaking to Hiroshi. And before I close off, I just want to take a page out of Dan's book and tell you about my new book called Someone Like Me. It's going to be out September 18th, so you can pre-order it now. I've been thinking a lot about family separation at the border and how awful it is, and also just thinking about my own separation from my family. We weren't separated at the border, but we were separated for 8 years. And so this issue of separation from family is one that is really dear to me and that I talk a lot about in my new book. So check it out. I hope that you enjoyed this conversation. Make sure that you rate us on iTunes or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Tell a friend about Crooked Conversations, and we'll see you next week.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. Like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.